You are listening to Circle A Radio. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For most people, the date of May 13th, 1985 is, to quote a phrase, a day that shall live in infamy. That's not just because of the horrific act of state terrorism that the date marks, or even the massacre of 11 Move people. It marks, once again, an instance of state injustice. For what made May 13th a day of remembrance is the brutal imprisonment of the Move 9, who, despite their innocence, were convicted of murder and sentenced to upwards of 100 years in Pennsylvania dungeons.
To date, no judge, no jury, no judicial nor law enforcement officer has condemned the May 13th bombing of MOVE. In fact, several, including former U.S. Attorney Edwin Meese and former Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates, have applauded it. The muted public response to the mass murder of MOVE members has set the stage for acceptable state violence against radicals, against blacks, and against all those deemed socially unacceptable. In the 60s and 70s, the Black Panther Party defined a relationship between the police and the black community as one between an occupying army and a colony. The confrontations between MOVE and this system's armed domestic forces has given that claim credence. Had Ramona Africa emerged from the sea of flames wrapped in fear, had she not instead escaped with her aura of resistance intact, she would have been free long before the 7 years she spent in a hellhole. Her prosecutor, describing MOVE as a cult of resistance, demanded jury convict her of a range of charges that, if they did so, would have exposed her to over 50 years in prison. Only her naturalist faith, the teachings of John Africa, allowed her to competently defend herself, where she beat the majority of the charges. Ramona is quote-unquote free today. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
On May 13, 1985, Philadelphia police dropped a bomb into a residential neighborhood from a helicopter. The target was the home of MOVE, a radical organization that protested police brutality and government policies, and advocated for members of the MOVE family who had been wrongfully imprisoned. 5 adults and 6 children were killed in the bombing. Despite 2 grand jury investigations and a commission finding that top officials were grossly negligent, no one from Philadelphia city government was criminally charged. Ramona Africa was the only adult survivor of the police bombing on MOVE. We spoke to her this past Sunday to mark the 21st anniversary of the MOVE bombing. Stay tuned.
In the early 1970s, a black man called John Africa began to talk to a friend of his who was a college professor, and he began to talk to him about what he believes in. And what John Africa believed in was life, is life, all life on every level, whether you're talking about human life, plant life, the air, the water, the soil that feeds us, plant life, all life, and how it's all important, all equal, and how it's all being abused, poisoned, maimed, killed by humans. And this college professor would take down the information that John Africa would put down, and he began to introduce it in his classroom. And as a result of that, there was a lot of interest, and there began to be study sessions, they were called, where John Africa would give some of these interested people information, and then they would have a meeting and all discuss it. As a result of these study sessions, people began to get more and more serious about the information they were getting and about life and the need to protect and defend life on all levels. Toward that end, the MOVE organization was formed, people who were serious and wanted to commit themselves to this work. And that was how the MOVE organization was formed. In the beginning of MOVE, which again was in the early 1970s, people were brought together from all different races, backgrounds, economic backgrounds, various religions, and MOVE people began to have demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations, at the Philadelphia Zoo, at the circus, in protest of the abuse and enslavement of animals. MOVE people had demonstrations, peaceful protests at meetings of huge multinational corporations, you know, DuPont Chemicals, Dow Chemicals, various other corporations that poisoned the environment. This is what MOVE did in the early days of MOVE, confronted these institutions and put out information to push people in the right direction. Initially, the police would just come out, they would observe, and that was it. Then they started taping what MOVE people were saying. And then when they realized the seriousness, this government felt threatened. The government, when they realized what the MOVE organization is saying, the information we're putting out, and the seriousness of it, they tried to at first buy us off by offering us funding, offering us money, offering us offices. And MOVE people made it clear that we cannot be bought, we cannot be co-opted, and that we're serious about our work. So when the system realized that they could not buy MOVE off, that's when the brutality and intimidation started. MOVE people would set up a peaceful demonstration. The cops would come and tell us that we had to disperse, we had to go away, go home. We could not have a protest. And MOVE people didn't just accept that. We would question it and say, why? What are you talking about? Isn't this America where you're supposed to have freedom of speech, freedom to protest, you know, all of these things that you tell the world exist in America? And, of course, the police did not want to hear that. And that's when the beating started. MOVE men were beat into concussions, broken limbs. MOVE women were beat. At one point, a three-week-old MOVE baby was knocked from his mother's arms and trampled to death by police. Life Africa was trampled to death on March 28th of 1976. In 1975, my sister Alberta Africa, who was married to John Africa, was several months pregnant when she was arrested at a peaceful demonstration and made it clear to the cops that she was pregnant. And they drug her out of the cell, held her down on the floor with her legs spread eagle and her arms spread out, while a black woman cop named Robinson viciously kicked her repeatedly in the vagina until she suffered a miscarriage. Two of my sisters, Janet and Lee Singh, were obviously pregnant when they were walking down the street and the cops threw them stomach first into the side of the police van and arrested them, took them into custody, let them sit in that van for a long time, not letting them go to the bathroom or anything, just torturing them. They eventually suffered miscarriages, both of them, from the torture that they suffered. That, too, was in 1975. People may have seen either video footage or still pictures of my brother Delbert Africa, one of the last people to come out of the house on August 8th of 78, being grabbed by his hair and drug across the street by his hair and being viciously kicked by a steel-toed boot-wearing cop, being hit repeatedly with a steel helmet by another cop and with the butt of a rifle of another cop on August 8th of 78. And these things were going on, and never would any of those responsible be held accountable. And MOVE people documented everything. We filed the necessary paperwork. But, of course, you can't go to the system that's attacking you and expect justice. So MOVE took a strong position and made it clear that we are a peaceful people. We are uncompromisingly opposed to violence. But we're not stupid. We are John Africa taught. And we are very clear on the difference between violence and self-defense. We are not violent, but neither are we masochistic or suicidal. And that we will defend ourselves if attacked by anybody, whether it's our next-door neighbor or this system. We don't see any difference. And we made it clear that this is instinctive, that this is the law, the law of life, the law of God, the law of Mother Nature that coordinates everything that's alive, and that we will defend ourselves. If it was our next door neighbor attacking us, then the system would tell us, you call the police, you call the system, you don't take the law into your own hands. They're famous for saying that. But when it's the system, the police, that's attacking you, who are you supposed to call? You know, what choice do you have but to defend yourself? And MOVE made our position clear, and that really, really, you know, made the system feel very threatened. And I think that's when they made a decision, really, that they needed to get rid of the MOVE organization. They tried to make an issue in 1977 of our home. They said there were housing code violations in our home. And, I mean, it was nonsense. Even if there were serious housing code violations, since when does the system care about poor people, particularly mainly black people, living in a home that has housing code violations? Since when do they care about that? So, obviously, it was just an excuse. And MOVE people weren't giving ground. We made it clear, you know, that's our home. We are not moving. A lot of MOVE people stayed at that house. And to really make it clear how it was nothing but an excuse on the part of this system, while they were making an issue of our home and saying that they wanted us out of there, they went to Richmond, Virginia, where some of our people went with some of the young children, and arrested our sisters and brought them back to Philadelphia. So how was the issue our home and getting MOVE people out of that home when the people that had left, they went and got and brought back? That was on August 5th of 78 when they went and got our sisters from Virginia and brought them back. On August 8th, hundreds and hundreds of cops surrounded our home, and they were armed for war. They also had the fire department out there, hundreds of firefighters out there. They began their attack on MOVE with the fire department. And these people who take an oath to save life, who are known to run into burning buildings to save people, actually use their equipment, their water cannons against MOVE people. They knew that MOVE people were in the basement, and they turned four deluge hoses on full force and flooded our basement with close to 6 feet of water, to the point where women that are small, such as myself, I'm like 4'11 and a half. I'm not even 5 feet. Some of my sisters are like 5 feet. They had to stand on tables and hold babies so that they would not drown. Then the police come in with tear gas and fill the basement with tear gas, knowing there's babies, pregnant women. Then the police opened fire, shot thousands of rounds of bullets into our home. Miraculously, no MOVE people were killed. But when the smoke cleared, a police officer had been shot and killed. Well, of course, in a situation like that, the police are never, ever going to admit that they messed up and shot one of their own. But it was obvious because this policeman that was shot was shot in the back of the neck, at the base of the neck, with the bullet traveling downward. This man was standing on street level, facing MOVE headquarters, facing my family, who was below him in the basement of MOVE headquarters. And that makes it physically impossible for any MOVE person to have shot him. And just like we know it, they know it. But it didn't matter because they didn't care about the police officer that was killed, these officials. All that was to them was more of an excuse to come at MOVE people. And since they had failed to kill MOVE, this was the perfect thing to pin on MOVE to put MOVE people in prison for as long as possible. That's all it was to them. They didn't care about that cop, and they knew that MOVE had not killed him. When the confrontation was over, they arrested 9 of my sisters and brothers. They were all charged with murder. Now, 9 people were arrested. This cop was shot with 1 bullet from 1 gun. How do 9 people fire 1 bullet? Impossible. And they know that, but they didn't care. They arrested my family, charged them, fried them, and convicted 9 people of shooting 1 cop with 1 bullet. I'm not talking about one person being proven as the person who shot this cop and killed him and the other 8 convicted of conspiracy. They convicted all 9 of my family members of murder when they could not show or prove in any way that any one of them shot and killed this cop. They were each sentenced to a 30-year minimum, a 100-year maximum sentence, and MOVE people, we didn't go crazy when that happened. We made sure that all of the necessary appeals were filed, but at the same time, we made it clear that we don't believe in this system and we don't rely on the same system that attacked us and tried to kill us and had been beating us up and locking us up for years, you know, for any kind of justice to make things right. We took our case and always take our case to the people, to the streets. And we kept information out in the streets, in the minds of the people. We explained to people what happened that day. We explained to people that immediately after arresting our family, how officials sent a demolition team out to where MOVE headquarters was and completely demolished our home, which was, according to them, the scene of a crime, the scene where a police officer had been shot to death. So why would they destroy evidence like that? They are trained to preserve evidence, not destroy it. But when it came to MOVE in August of 1978, they completely destroyed the scene of the crime. At that point, there should not have even been a trial at all once they destroyed the evidence. But when does that mean anything to these people? Like I said, they proceeded to prosecute my family, convicted them, all 9, of murder, and my family has been sitting in prison ever since, 28 years this year. It is our righteous and unrelenting protest of this injustice that led to the May 13th, 1985 bombing. MOVE people would not shut up. We would not stop making an issue of what was happening with our family. And because these officials could not shut us up, they had a lot of pressure on them because more and more people were paying attention to what we're saying and questioning them about it. So they had a decision to make. They had to do something to relieve that pressure. Now, they had 2 options. They could either do the right thing and do whatever was necessary to release our innocent family members from prison, or they could continue on with their conspiracy and try to stop us from making an issue of it, try to shut us up. Obviously, they chose the latter. They chose to try to shut us up. And that is what the May 13th, 1985 bombing was about. Officials through the media tried to tell people that it was about some complaints from our neighbors and that they had to do something about, you know, move because of complaints from our neighbors. That is nonsense. They don't care about black people complaining about their neighbors. Never have. And furthermore, what are they saying when a neighbor complains about another neighbor that the solution to that problem is to bomb the neighborhood and burn it down? In that case, there would be no United States of America because there is not one neighborhood in this whole country where one or some neighbors don't have complaints about another or other neighbors. So, I mean, it makes no sense. Obviously, it was more to it than that. And what it was that they wanted to silence us permanently. They wanted to wipe us out so that they would not have to deal with, you know, the pressure we have on them about our family members that are in prison. That's what the May 13th bombing was about. And that was 21 years ago yesterday on May 13th of 1985. But what I want to point out is that while the bombing actually took place on what was a Monday, May 13th of 1985, the initial attack, the beginning of their attack on us, took place on Sunday, May 12th. Which was Mother's Day of 1985. That's when they initiated their attack on MOVE. And their intent, just like in 1978, was to kill, not to arrest, not to take into custody, but to kill. And because with all of their artillery and all of their manpower that they had out there, they failed to kill MOVE in 78. They were outraged. They were livid. They were upset. And so when they came back in 1985, they were determined to do what they had failed to do in 78, which is why they not only came with the same artillery they had in 78, plus heavier artillery in the form of 50 caliber machine guns and M60 automatic rifles. They also came with the makings of a bomb. They came with a plastic explosive known as C4, which is a military explosive that no municipal police department has. It would have to be obtained from the federal government, from the FBI, who supplied 37.5 pounds of this plastic explosive to the Philadelphia Police Department. They were all in it together. This was not just a local Philadelphia Police Department attack. It was it involved the state government and the federal government, the U.S. Justice Department, the FBI, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, who supplied this heavy artillery. And we found out later, I mean, it came out later, how they had been rehearsing and practicing their attack on MOVE for close to a year before May of 85. They even built a simulation of our home, our roof, and practiced blowing it up. So this was not things going out of control. This was not bad judgment, you know. This was deliberate murder. They did exactly what they planned to do. Like I said, they were determined to do in 85 what they had failed to do in 78, which is why they dropped that bomb on our home, and which is why the fire department, who had poured tons of water in and on our home for hours when there was no fire, refused to do anything to put out the fire when they knew it was a fire on our roof. They turned the water off and would not try to extinguish the fire. So this was no accident. This was not officials trying to arrest, move people. This was out-and-out murder. And to crystallize it even more, when they dropped that bomb on our home, we were in the basement. And at the point that we realized our home was on fire, we immediately tried to get ourselves, our children, our animals out of that blazing inferno. We were hollering out that we were coming out. The instant we were visible to the police trying to come out, they deliberately opened fire. They deliberately started shooting and took direct aim and tried to shoot, you know, us to death or back into that blazing inferno. That is the reason that 11 people, 5 babies and 6 adults, were murdered that day. That's how it happened. And that's why I say it was murder. It was not an accident, things getting out of control, bad judgment, none of the things that, you know, these officials try to use to excuse what they did May 13th of 1985. Till this day, nobody, not one single official, has ever been held accountable for the murders they committed that day.
You are listening to an interview with Ramona Africa. This is Circle A Radio here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Ramona, I'm wondering what kind of media coverage was being put on MOVE before and after the bombing in 85.
From the very beginning of MOVE, the media has been used by those in authority to paint a picture of MOVE that would hopefully cause people, you know, in their eyes, hopefully cause people to feel like we deserve everything that the government hurls on us. Mumia is the only journalist who consistently and accurately reported on MOVE. He went and interviewed officials. He also interviewed MOVE people, came up to the prison and interviewed MOVE people. He sat in the courtroom during the trial, you know, of MOVE people, and including John Africa's trial in federal court. So the difference between Mumia and these other people is that Mumia told the truth, you know, while these other journalists just did what the system wanted them to do, which was to try to create justification for this system exterminating MOVE. And the thing is, you know, they said the things that you just mentioned, that we threw garbage in the backyard, which was a lie. But the thing is, we don't see food as trash. We believe Mama, Mother Nature, feeds us, and that we, in turn, have to feed her. So when we eat grapes, we put the seeds back in the earth, in the dirt. When we eat an orange, we don't see the orange peeling or the orange seeds as trash. We put it back in the earth. Now, people did go crazy and talk about we were throwing garbage in the yard, et cetera. But meanwhile, years later, this system puts a cute little word called composting on it, and now it's the thing to do. You know, they said we stink because we eat garlic, which is extremely healthy for you. Now you have doctors and everybody talking about garlic, the wonder food, you know. So the things that this system has said about MOVE is just ridiculous. Add all these things up together, and it can never amount to justification for what they've done to MOVE. We were not accused of selling drugs, distributing drugs in the community and schools. We're not accused of rape of robbery or anything like that. But they drop a bomb on us. They attack our home the way they did in 78. I mean, there is no justification for it, and that is the point that people have to get to, honest, fair-minded people, because if you are prejudiced, if you are one-sided and you want to think a certain way, nothing anybody says or does is going to change your mind. But any honest, fair-minded person should have the attitude that it doesn't matter what the system says. Nothing can justify what they did. And it has nothing to do with whether or not you support the MOVE organization or not, because the viciousness of this system, it was demonstrated on August 8th of 78 and May 13th of 1985, but it is also demonstrated every day in this system. I mean, Amadou Diallo, the West African brother in New York, was not a MOVE member, was not an activist, a revolutionary, involved in any revolutionary activity. This man was standing in the doorway of his home when he was shot at 41 times by police, hit 19 times, several of those bullets through the bottom of his feet, indicating that he was in a prone position, shot down, and they continued to shoot at him. This man wasn't a revolutionary. They didn't accuse him of being dirty or nasty or a problem in his neighborhood. All the things they try to throw at MOVE, they didn't accuse him of any of those things. So why was he shot at 41 times by police? And he was unarmed. You know, people need to understand this is not a MOVE issue. This is an issue of how out of control this system is and the urgent need for everybody to pull in the reins to put things right, not in defense or protection of MOVE, but in defense of themselves and their families. As long as this mentality exists in this system, nobody is safe. Black, white, red, yellow, whatever. Nobody is safe. Man, woman, child. Nobody. It is not enough to complain and philosophize about the state of things today, the state of this world today. That is not enough. That is futile. As futile as, you know, complaining about being hungry and doing nothing about solving the problem of being hungry by doing what's necessary to get some food. We can complain about this system from now till kingdom comes, as they said. That is not going to accomplish anything unless we are willing to get up off our butts and be involved in putting things right. Nothing is going to change. Our condition is never going to improve. We are sending a very dangerous message to those in authority that they have free reign. They can do whatever they want and don't have to worry about people taking a strong, uncompromising, consistent position against them. I mean, that's the message that they are receiving. Unless we change that, we're done. Over the years, no official has ever been held accountable for their crimes against MOVE. In fact, even after May 13th, when I filed a civil suit naming, I mean, a long list of people involved in the conspiracy to murder MOVE people and the actual bombing and murder of me and my family. By the time, 11 years later, 1996, that this federal lawsuit went to trial, every single defendant that I named in that lawsuit, with the exception of three, the city of Philadelphia, the police commissioner, and the fire commissioner, with the exception of those three, everybody else was dismissed from the suit, given immunity. when we went to trial, and it was a long trial, and the jury was a predominantly white jury from the suburbs, but they found those three, the city of Philadelphia, the fire commissioner, and the police commissioner, guilty, found them liable. The judge comes back and overturns the jury's verdict and grants immunity after the verdict to the police commissioner and the fire commissioner. When you have examples like this, and this is just a few of many, how in the world can people be expected to have any faith in this system, to look to it for any kind of justice or righteousness? You know, they want people to believe that you have to abide by the system, by its rules, its laws, by legality, as if legality is synonymous with right and that it always turns out right. And that is just a blatant lie, you know? Legal has never, ever been synonymous with right, because you can be legal and do what's legal and be wrong. But you can't be right and be wrong. That's what John Africa teaches us. Slavery was legal. The Holocaust was legal. Apartheid was legal. But none of those things are right. Resisting apartheid, the Holocaust, slavery, was illegal, seen as a crime. It was right to resist those abominations. So what John Africa teaches us can be proven right, is proven right. But what this system is pushing has been proven wrong for ever since.
We wanted to ask you a little bit about your own experiences within MOVE.
I come from a middle-class black family. I went to Catholic school from 1st to 12th grade. Then I went to Temple University. I didn't really know anything personally, really, about oppression, injustice. I mean, I experienced some things. Mostly I read about stuff, and that's all it was just something I read, something I heard about. I didn't really have a clue. I was going to Temple University. I had a pre-law curriculum, and I was going to go on to law school and become a lawyer, and my mother was constantly telling me that maybe I would go on to be a judge, maybe the first black woman U.S. Supreme Court justice. You know, I mean, that's where I was headed. And then I met MOVE. I met MOVE in the spring of 1979, and what happened was this friend of mine had called me and asked me, did I want to go to a meeting to plan a MOVE demonstration? I said, yeah, I would like to go. I said, you know, I heard of MOVE, I've read about MOVE over the years, you know, because I lived in West Philadelphia all my life where MOVE was located, but I just never had the interest to go down to MOVE headquarters and talk to MOVE people, you know, personally and find out what's going on. But at this point in 1979, I did. I went to that meeting and met some MOVE supporters and got information that I didn't know and was shocked that I lived in West Philadelphia all my life and didn't know these things about MOVE and thought I had even read about MOVE, so why didn't I know these things? And it piqued my interest. And one of the MOVE supporters I met then, who is now a MOVE member along with myself, encouraged me because she knew I was going to law school and that I was interested in the court system and legality. She encouraged me to go over to City Hall and sit in on some of the MOVE trials and see for myself what was going on. And I did. And what I saw in those courtrooms really changed my life, you know, because sitting in a classroom reading a textbook and listening to a professor talk about how things are supposed to operate is one thing, but sitting in the actual courtroom and seeing firsthand what's going on is something completely different. None of what I read in those textbooks or heard in those classrooms happening in that courtroom. None of it. I saw the racism, the blatant railroading, and I was shocked. I was like, but he can't do that. How can that judge do that? How can that prosecutor get away with this? And I was just shocked. But on the other hand, I saw MOVE members representing themselves and doing an excellent job of it. I mean, exposing the lies that the police witnesses and other officials were telling. I mean, exposing them clearly, stating their position very simply and clearly, not being intimidated by the judge, the prosecutor, or anything else concerning that courtroom or the trial. And I was thoroughly impressed with MOVE, and it kept me coming back. And then I started going up to the prison with MOVE supporters to visit MOVE political prisoners and to talk to them personally. At the point I started getting that much involved and coming to court regularly, I became known as a MOVE supporter, and then I started getting harassed by the police and treated different. So I saw it firsthand what was going on, and at one point I got arrested just for trying to go back into the MOVE trial when the judge, knowing that I was a MOVE supporter, barred me from the courtroom, and I tried to go back anyway. I ended up getting arrested. When I went to trial, I represented myself like I saw MOVE people do. The judge found me guilty, and when she was ready to sentence me, she asked me, did I have anything to say? And I said, yes, I do. And I just started talking about how I felt and what I had seen and who was the real criminal. And she told me to shut up. And I said, well, didn't you ask me, did I have anything to say? And isn't there a such thing as freedom of speech? Can't I state my position? She said no. And I kept talking, and she held me in contempt of court and sentenced me to 60 days in prison. Well, when she sent me to prison, she sent me right up there with MOVE women. So I spent 60 days housed with MOVE women in the prison. Well, after that, it was a done deal. You know, I wasn't going anywhere after that. I was firmly committed to MOVE then. I understood what MOVE people were saying. I made a decision at that point that I didn't want to go to law school. I didn't want to be like the judge or the prosecuting attorney or even the so-called defense attorneys that were appointed as like backup counsel for MOVE people, even though they were representing themselves. I didn't want to be like any of them. I wanted to be like MOVE people. So I made a decision that I didn't want to go to law school after that, and I was firmly ensconced in MOVE at that point.
What does it mean when you say, long live John Africa?
It's an homage to John Africa, who was a strong, dedicated, committed, deeply spiritual revolutionary. We think of him. We never want to forget him. We remember the many lessons he taught people. We thank him for bringing the MOVE organization, for finding it, for teaching and energizing and bringing those people, you know, from the dead level to the movement,
National
to the revolution.
Organization.
So we never want to forget.
And how do you characterize your association with MOVE?
Most would characterize it as a MOVE supporter. I support them because they're very inspiring people, very deeply committed people, very heroic brothers and sisters.
Right.
Who have fought and tend to fight and will fight tomorrow. You know, have fought for decades against the system.
People who just can't compromise with their integrity or their liberty.
Never have and never will.
In
1981,
when John Africa was arrested in Rochester, New York, and brought back to Philadelphia to stand trial in federal court, and despite how hard they tried to get John Africa and convict him and sentence him to prison for the rest of his life, John Africa was acquitted of every single charge. in federal court and walked out of there with nothing hanging over him.
An article had reference to Donald Glassy becoming a federal informer.
Right. Donald Glassy was the college professor
nuclear power
that I spoke about earlier, who was a friend of John Africa,
know how it's stored
and that John Africa would, you know, give a lot of information to, talk to him about his beliefs. And Donald Glassy would, you know, take down the information and begin to introduce it into his college class. This man, he was an educated, middle-class white man, and during the early demonstrations
that were coordinated, where
MOVE people were attacked by police, Donald Glassy was also attacked, and attacked, you know, viciously, because this system resents white people, particularly middle-class and upper-class white people that have come to MOVE, because they see them as, like, traitors and, you know, what are you doing with those people kind of thing. And so he suffered a lot of brutality at the hands of this system. And he could not take it. He couldn't take it. He was just, you know, too weak. He couldn't handle it. And at some point, we don't know exactly when, but at some point, you know, the government got to him and intimidated him, you know, intimidated him into being an agent for them and to saying whatever they wanted him to say. And, you know, that's all that's really happening with that man. He came into federal court in 1981 when John Africa was on trial and testified, and John Africa didn't have a problem with him. He wasn't angry at him. He understood exactly what was happening. When he came off the witness stand and walked out, John Africa went over to him and hugged him, you know, because he understood exactly what was happening with him. When John Africa came home, things really heated up and escalated, and the system was feeling a lot of pressure. That what led to the May 13th bombing. John Africa was murdered in the bombing, and I was arrested. I was in prison for 7 years. I was convicted of riot and sentenced to 16 months to 7 years in prison. When my 16-month minimum sentence was over, I was interviewed for early release for parole, and I was told that the government was willing to parole me, to release me early, if I agreed to sever all ties with MOVE and have absolutely no contact with MOVE at all. I told them they could go to hell, that I wasn't accepting that stipulation. And several of my sisters and brothers who became eligible for parole after that had the same stipulation put on them, and not one of us accepted it. So I ended up doing the whole 7 years. When that 7 years was up, the day I was released, they released me at 3 a.m. in the morning. Usually they tell you you cannot be released before 6 a.m. They never let anybody be released before that. They told me I was being released at 3 a.m. and that if I couldn't arrange transportation, whatever, they would drive me to the bus stop and drop me off. Now, we're talking about up in the hills of upstate Pennsylvania, which is extremely racist, known Ku Klux Klan territory. Well, people were outraged about that, and a whole car caravan came up to pick me up. When I left that prison that morning, I went right to a radio program, to a press conference, to another radio program. The next day, I went to New York City to do the Today Show. Then I flew to Washington to do a BET program. And from that point on, I've been doing speaking engagements, speaking at colleges, communities, churches, all over the place. And keeping information out there about MOVE, pushing for support for and the release of the Move 9, my family members that are still in prison. Nothing has slowed down at all.
The Move family, the individuals within Move, were very concerned about their health, about education, about empowerment of their children, about being vocal against the system. I feel like that was their big mistake in the eyes of the system.
Everything that we do and believe in is really a threat to the system. And I mean from so-called birth to so-called death and everything in between, because Move women are taught value our health and protect our health and to be healthy enough to have our babies naturally at home. Some people would say, so what's the big deal with that? Other people would say, if that's what people want to do, you know, that's on them. But, you know, there could be complications, blah, blah, blah. So people might have different positions. But the one thing that is threatening about that to the system is they make billions of dollars off of convincing women to go to hospitals to have their babies. Meanwhile, there is no other species of life in existence, nowhere on the face of this earth, that goes to a hospital to have a baby. None. So you're talking about influencing health and strength in people, in women, and cutting into the billions of dollars that these people make off of that one thing. John Africa urges us and has given us a raw food diet to eat. Now, we don't eat all raw food, but we eat a lot of raw food and are working to the point where we eat all raw food. What does that mean to this system? It means that you're not going to McDonald's, that you're not buying candy and food with all kinds of chemicals in it. You're not doing that. You're buying simple food from the earth. Now, is that in the interest of this system? When you care about your health, it means that you don't want the earth that grows your food to be poisoned. You don't want chemicals and preservatives in your food. Those are multi-billion dollar industries. Then, once we have our babies, we don't turn our babies over to this system to so-called educate. Our children are homeschooled. We keep our children with us because we don't want them indoctrinated by the system and be trained to believe in the system, which is the only thing that these schools can teach children and do teach children. Most people will not do that. Our children are homeschooled. That's something the system doesn't want because they want to get their hands on children. So from a very early age and an earlier and earlier age, they can begin to program children to believe in the system, to be robots and slaves, you know, to this system. I'm saying everything that we believe in and the way we do things based on our belief, the teaching of John Africa, is a threat to this system. But everything that we believe in and that we do based on that belief is also very healthy, freedom-orienting, satisfying to life. You know, not just to us, but all life. Because if the world lived as John Africa teaches, there would be no cops, no guns, no rape, murder, no drugs, no oppression or slavery. Life would be free. The earth would be fertile. The water would be pure. Now, that's what Move John Africa is talking about.
This system has failed you yesterday, failed you today, and has created the conditions for failure tomorrow. For society is wrong. The system is reeling. The courts of this complex are filled with imbalance. Cops are insane. The judges enslaving. The lawyers are just as the judges they confront. They are Harvard and Princeton and Cornell and Yale and trained as the judge to deceive the impoverished, trained as the judge to protect the established, trained by the system to be as the system, to do for the system, exploit with the system, and move ain't gonna close our eyes to this monster. Unquote from John Africa's Judges letter. It was true then. It's even truer now. This system has failed all of us. Indeed, it is the problem. Organize this very day to resist it, to oppose it, to go beyond it. Demand that all imprisoned MOVE members be released and all political prisoners be freed. That is a beginning. That is a first step we can all take today. On the MOVE, long live John Africa. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Mumia Abu-Jamal was interviewed by Noel Hanrahan, who is also the producer for his prison radio commentaries. Prison Radio's mission is to challenge mass incarceration and racism by airing the voices of men and women in prison and by bringing their voices into the public dialogue on crime and punishment. For more information, go to www.prisonradio.org. The MOVE website is www.onamove.com. We'd like to thank Ramona Africa, Noel Hanrahan, and Mumia Abu-Jamal. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesdays of the month here on KBOO. Our next show will air June 7th at 6 p.m. We can be reached through www.circlearadio.org. Thanks for listening.
Lord, I gotta keep on moving. Lord, I gotta get on down. Lord, I gotta keep on moving. Where I can be found. Lord, the time is out to me.
I've been accused for the killing. Didn't do for hanging me there. I'm willing, yeah, yeah, and that's why I gotta get on through. Lord, the time's after me.
I want more time.
Lord, I gotta keep on.
Just gonna suffer now.